Ave listeners, a quick announcement before the new podcast commences. Rhiannon Evans and I are now fundraising for Series 2 of the Caesar's Gallic War podcast, in which we make our way through Caesar's most famous campaign in intricate detail. This is a supporter-only podcast, so if you want to hear it, why not check it out? Go to kickstarter.com and search for Caesar's Gallic War. Thanks. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University, Frankfurt. This is episode CXXIV, The Lowest Depths of Foulness. As you can tell from this episode title, Dio wasn't the biggest fan of Elagabalus, and he wasn't alone there. When Elagabalus finally arrived at Rome, the city seemed to hold its breath. The young emperor embraced both the roles of ruler and high priest of a foreign religion, but there were many that questioned where his priorities lie. Here's Kaelin Davenport. So now we are into the reign of Elagabalus, so please explain his many names.
His many names, yes.
I'm looking at you, Dio.
Yeah, so the problem is we have his birth name, which is Varius Avitus Bassianus. We also have the name which he was called as emperor, his official imperial name, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus.
And that's not unusual for an entirely new name to be taken as an imperial name. So I'm not holding that against him at this point.
No, we can't hold that against him. There were various other nicknames that he had at the time, either given by Dio or in popular usage. And at the beginning of book 80, Dio gives a rundown of these various names. He says in 80.1, now Avitus, otherwise known as the false Antoninus, or the Assyrian, or Sardanapalus, or even Tiberinus, this last appellation he received after he had been slain and his body had been thrown into the Tiber.
Yeah, that's spoilers right in the first chapter.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dio. Yes.
Again, not you. Stop apologising for Dio.
Yes, he wants his readers to know that it's going to turn out very badly.
So, Sardanapalus, that sounds like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon character.
Yes, yeah. In this case, it's a Syrian king. The Assyrians as an Eastern Empire are assimilated with decadence in Roman thought, and he was a legendary king towards the end of the Assyrian Empire, known for his luxury, debauchery and decadence. So that's why he got the nicknames of either Assyrian or Sardanapalus. And Dio really plays up the character faults that he sees associated with people from Syria.
Okay. So Dio mostly calls him false Antoninus, I believe.
Yes, false Antoninus. Herodian calls him Antoninus. The Augustan history calls him Antoninus Heliogabalus. So the cult that he was in charge of was the cult of the mountain god Elagabal in Emesa, who is assimilated with the sun as well. So Heliogabalus adds the emphasis on the sun there, Helios. However, most scholars today call him Elagabalus, named after the god Elagabal. So, and you see in most scholarly works, such as Martin Ickes's recent excellent biography, The Crimes of Elagabalus, that's what we call him.
Okay, and why do we do that? Because that's not a name that seems to have come from a historical source at all.
Well, once again, we're relying on a nickname. Probably, again, Heliogabalus is the closest we get to Elagabalus. It's just a different form of that, which has been established in modern scholarship. But earlier in the 20th century, scholars did call him Heliogabalus. There is a book which has the wonderful title of The Amazing Emperor Heliogabalus, which I think was written in the 1920s, which is just fantastic because, you know, it buys into all the craziness which goes on.
Well, that sounds like a Roald Dahl book.
Yes, yeah, The Amazing Emperor Heliogabalus, yes, exactly. Yes, so I'll now call him Elagabalus from now on, to hopefully not confuse people too much.
All right, so we're now caught up.
Yeah.
But that's why when I was reading through Book 80 of Dio, I get partway through and I'm going, who's this Sardanapalus?
Yes.
Is this another person that suddenly cropped up? And then I went back to the top and I realized, oh no, this is actually Elagabalus. Mm. He's just bringing in a different name at this point.
And this is what Dio does throughout the history of the later Severans. So he refers to Caracalla as the gladiator nickname, Taraltas.
He does, yeah, yeah.
He just likes to use these nicknames to denigrate the emperors. Mm. This is a part of his style. And it seems particularly the name of Antoninus provoked debate, because Dio calls him the false Antoninus, you know, saying that he's not a real Antonine. And the Historia Augusta really takes up this theme as well in its life of Elagabalus. So this is in section 7. Historia Augusta criticizes how Macrinus's son Diogeminianus was called Antoninus, and then Elagabalus was as well. I'll just read this out because it's quite a wonderful passage. Now to Macrinus' son, previously called Diogeminianus, he gave the name Antoninus, after he had himself assumed the appellation Felix, fortunate, in order to avert the suspicion of having slain Antoninus. This same name was afterwards taken by Verus Elagabalus also, who claimed to be the son of Bassianus, a most filthy creature, and the son of a harlot. Indeed, there are still in existence some verses written by a certain poet, which relate how the name of the Antonines, which began with Pius, gradually sank from one Antonine to another to the lowest degradation. For Marcus alone, by his manner of life, exalted that holy name, while Verus lowered, and Commodus even profaned the reverence due to the consecrated name. And what can we say of Caracalla Antoninus, and who of the youth Diogeminianus? And finally, what of Elagabalus, the last of the Antonines, who is said to have lived in the lowest depths of foulness?
Good reading.
It's fantastic, isn't it? It sells itself. I mean, it's just showing how this name of people like Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius have been appropriated by the Severan family, and it shows how dynastic politics was contested at this time. Now, at the same time, Elagabalus was actually styled the son of the deified Antoninus Magnus, Antoninus the Great, who is Caracalla.
Okay.
So Caracalla is deified and it's given the appellation of Magnus the Great, and he's given this under both Elagabalus's reign and Severus Alexander's reign. So he is the son and then the grandson of the deified Septimius Severus. So we see this dynastic continuity really being promoted here. But the mothers also play important roles in the public image of the regime. So Julia Maesa, Elagabalus's grandmother, and Julia Soimias, his mother, were given the title of Augusta. Maesa was honoured also in the vows made by the senatorial priesthood, the Arval Brethren, as grandmother of the emperor. You might remember from the Caracalla episodes that Julia Domna had also been honoured by the Arvals in this fashion. So we actually have an imperial grandmother honoured, which is unprecedented. And Soimias has the title of Mater Augusti, mother of the emperor. So we see this emphasis on imperial motherhood, the female line of the dynasty continuing as it had under Caracalla. They provide the legitimacy.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really interesting.
It's interesting that they draw their legitimacy from that, because if that had happened in the past, I think you've got things like Claudius being related to Antony. He could have drawn that legitimacy from that way if Antony wasn't the losing side. The family tree can be respectable if you want it to be, from no matter where it is.
Very much so. But you know, this is part of the link of drawing back to Septimius Severus and Caracalla and really portraying Macrinus as an aberration. That episode is over. The Severans are back in control, is the message.
What the hell was that speed bump? Anyone see that cow that we hit? Yep.
Or cut in half.
Now that Elagabalus is the only Caesar, the uncontested Caesar, I suppose, Rome needs to prepare itself for another new reality.
Yes. And Elagabalus' aim is to go back to Rome, but he takes over a year to return to Rome. So he's acknowledged by the Senate in July 218, but doesn't arrive in Rome until August, September 219. He travels overland through Asia Minor, spending the winter of 218-219 at Nicomedia, where Caracalla had also wintered. And what this means is a lot of his early dealings with the Senate are through letters.
Yeah.
This is a young boy who had been part of the imperial court, but he's still only 14. He's still not really a known quantity, but his mother and grandmother are certainly known within senatorial circles. Once again, like Macrinus, he gives himself the names and titles of emperor without waiting for the Senate first. He makes himself consul for 218, despite the fact that Macrinus is already consul for 218. He's dead, so his name gets scratched out, and Elagabalus is now consul for that year as well.
Is that Damnatio Memoriae?
Well, yes, because it's replacing him as consul there. A lot of the time, Damnatio Memoriae was up to individual agents and governors to enact it.
Mm.
But certainly by replacing him as consul, this would be scrubbing his name out from that year. There is a sort of a real change in attitude. So people in Rome, you know, who had criticized Caracalla, you know, they're now grateful to his son, alleged son, coming back. And in Herodian's narrative, you know, this return is really driven by Mysa, who wants to go back to Rome and return to her center of power in the palace.
But there's no kind of indication of why it's taking a year to get back.
I think they want to consolidate their position in Syria, and then they choose to travel overland.
Which takes time.
Which takes time. And I think also because Macrinus had appointed a lot of his own associates in the eastern provinces, they have to be removed and replaced with Elagabalus's own associates. And I think by people seeing the emperor moving through the eastern provinces, that provides a sense of reassurance. So he executed the governor of Syria, Fabius Agrippinus, who had supported Macrinus. When the governor of Arabia, Picca Caesianus, didn't immediately declare his allegiance to Elagabalus, he was executed. Some of Caracalla's supporters, including Septimius Castinus, were murdered. And Dio complains that no statements about these murders were given to the Senate, so they were just executed.
Mm.
And then he promoted his own associates, including Valerius Commazon, who had allegedly started off his life as a mime actor, and then entered the army, and now is commander of the Praetorian Guard. And Dio completely hates him because he later became consul and city prefect.
Wow, that's a strange left turn for a career.
It is, and Dio must have known this man personally as well, because, you know, they were in the Senate at the same time. Commazon survives the reign of Elagabalus into the reign of Severus Alexander, and Dio is incredibly critical of his career. He talks about him like he's changing masks each time as if he was still an actor. So things aren't going well for those who supported Macrinus or Elagabalus. And there are various stories about people who are executed even before Elagabalus reaches Rome. Seius Carus, son of a former prefect of the city, is alleged to have been trying to gain support from the soldiers stationed at Alba. A man named Valerianus Paetus is executed, and this is what Dio says, because he had stamped some likenesses of himself and plated them with gold to serve as ornaments for his mistresses. If you plate images of yourself with gold, people might think you're creating your own coinage, and you're not allowed to do that because only the emperor can mint coinage. And it was thought that he was going off to Cappadocia to stage his own rebellion there. A man named Silius Messala, again a leading associate, was summoned to Syria by Elagabalus. There he is executed as well. This shows the terror which Elagabalus was able to inflict upon the Senate while still in Syria. The other person he executes, and he waits until Nicomedia to do this, is Eutychianus, the man who in Dio's account, led his revolt and was having an affair with Soimias.
Oh, and took him to the camp.
Yeah, yes.
Without his grandmother's knowledge.
That's right, yeah. Yes. And this is the man called Eutychianus, also known as Gannus, just to, you know, confuse us all with the various names. Allegedly, he wanted to be made Caesar, so deputy emperor, so off with his head as well.
Mm.
So the idea is that, you know, he's consolidating his rule, his authority with these executions, you know. Must remember, he's only a teenager.
Mm. In his defence, he's maybe learning from Macrinus' mistakes as well.
Yes, definitely. As a Roman emperor, you have to be firm and establish your authority and get rid of your enemies. So in this, he really takes after his alleged father, but actual cousin, Caracalla.
So Elagabalus is the chief priest and has been brought up to think of himself in that role and persona. How does he consolidate these two responsibilities that he now has? He really tries to hang on to his religious role, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah. He makes the transition to Roman emperor with great difficulty. And this is why we have so many negative accounts of Elagabalus, is that he does not behave as a Roman emperor should. And there have been lots of young emperors who have not behaved as a Roman emperor should, you know, Nero, Caligula, Commodus, Caracalla. Elagabalus is a whole nother level because of his Syrian religious practices and his continuance as the priest of Elagabalus. And this apparently begins in Nicomedia during this winter of 218, 219. Herodian says, immediately he plunged into his mad activities, performing for his native god the fantastic rites in which he had been trained from childhood. So leaving aside the prejudice we can say that Elagabalus didn't want to give up his priestly role. This worried Julia Maissa because, you know, she is experienced with the imperial court, with the Senate, and she's worried that Elagabalus continuing to perform as a priest might upset sensibilities in Rome as well as with the army.
Mm.
What Elagabalus tries to do is to try and acclimatise the Senate to his dress as the priest of Elagabalus. So he sends a portrait of himself to hang in the Senate house. And this, Herodian says, was because he wished the Senate and the Roman people to grow accustomed to seeing him in this costume and wished to test their reaction to this exotic sight.
It'd be great to see that portrait.
I would love to see that.
So he'd be wearing outlandish religious clothing.
His robes as the priesthood of the priest. There'd be necklaces and a crown. So Maissa doesn't want him to do this. I mean, it's quite common for emperors to send advance portraits if they've been acclaimed outside. But yeah, this would have been something else. The Herodian actually says, the Romans, conditioned by the painting, found nothing strange in the sight when he appeared.
Okay, so it had its desired effect.
Yeah, it had its desired effect. I mean, they're expecting this is what their emperor would look like, you know, when he is in his robes as the priest.
Hmm.
One of the issues, however, is that he not only wears the clothes of the priest of Elagabalus, he continues to perform the role. So he builds a large temple to Elagabalus on the Palatine Hill in Rome. So the Palatine is where the Roman emperors live. And you can still see the large foundations of this today.
Really?
It's on the northeast corner, and it's close to the Colosseum. It was probably on the site of an earlier part of the palace that had been there since the reign of Domitian, but it now became the Elagabalium, a tongue twister there.
The Elagabalium.
The Elagabalium. So this is where he would perform the rites as the priest of the god, and he also brought the sacred stone, the bital, the representation of Elagabalus, to Rome. And we see this on coins that are minted. The stone is brought on a chariot, you know, led by horses. There are parasols as part of the procession.
Mm.
It was really a quite exceptional experience. Now, listeners might think, you know, Rome had often incorporated foreign cults. You know, there were lots of Eastern religions that flourished under the Roman Empire. Why did Elagabalus cause such horror? Dio provides clear indication here, and this is in Book 80, 11.1, and I quote, "The offence consisted not in his introducing a foreign god into Rome, or in his exalting him in very strange ways, but in his placing him even before Jupiter himself and causing himself to be voted his priest."
Right, okay, so they've got no problem with accommodating other gods.
No.
As long as those gods know their place.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And especially before Jupiter, the king of the Roman gods. He takes the title in 220 of Sacerdos Amplissimus Dei Invicti Solis Elegabali, which translates from Latin into the most distinguished priest of the god, the unconquered son Elegabalus. And this title was used in his official titulature, so inscriptions on letters, and it went before that of Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest of the Roman state.
Okay, so Elegabalus has its place, and its place is the first beyond all else.
So. Exactly. So it's not the worship of Elagabalus.
Yeah.
I mean, it had been popular. You can find dedications to Elagabalus at army sites along the Danube, for example, by Syrian soldiers there. It's not the fact that there is a cult. It's the fact that the emperor is behaving as the priest and also exalting himself and the god above Jupiter. But, you know, all members of the Senate, the equestrian order, were expected to come and watch Elagabalus sacrificing at the new temple. Herodian says he directed all Roman officials who perform public sacrifices to call upon Elagabalus before all other gods. So once again, it's offending traditional sensibilities there. But Dio also complains about another aspect. So he has a list of complaints as to why it isn't acceptable. He goes on to say, again, in Book 80, Chapter 11, "Also," this is another problem, "in his circumcising himself and abstaining from swine's flesh on the grounds that his devotion would thereby be purer. He had planned, indeed, to cut off his genitals altogether, but that desire was prompted solely by his effeminacy. The circumcision which he actually carried out was a part of the priestly requirements of Elagabalus, and he accordingly mutilated many of his companions in like manner." There are lots of stories to do with Elagabalus's gender identity and his sexuality, many of which we will deal with in the next episode. But I want to point out here that castration, which is what Dio seems to mean by cutting off his genitals, was often a part of Eastern religions. So the priests of Cybele, the male Galli, they're called, castrated themselves. And this was part of their initiation as priests. And there was a chief priest, the Arch Gallus, who presided over this at Rome. And the cult of Cybele or Magna Mater had been part of Roman religion since the Republican period. So it isn't the idea that the religion and the beliefs are bad, but it's unbecoming for a Roman emperor to behave in this way.
There seems to be a lot of that going on, though. Dio seems to have a lot of problems with how Elagabalus is acting and presenting himself. Part of me is inclined just to go, man, he's a teenager, give him a break.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll get to this in the next episode, but quite a lot of this just seems to be confusion at the time.
Yes.
This is a young man who has been raised and his entire life he's probably been told, you are the chief priest.
Yep.
This is how we worship the god.
Yeah.
This is your role. This is how you do it. This is how you dress. This is how we act. And that god is the most important god amongst all else. Just because he becomes emperor, that doesn't change.
Exactly. It doesn't change his upbringing, doesn't change his religion, doesn't change his culture.
Yes.
So there's a clash on where he sees himself and the expectations of what a Roman emperor is supposed to be like.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes, he is a teenager when he's murdered. You know, he's barely 20. So he's a young man thrust into power and he's continuing to behave as he thinks he should. And so, you know, there's descriptions in Dio about him dancing, performing sacrifices, receiving salutations. But, you know, the dancing was part of the orgiastic rites which he performed as Elagabalus. And again, this is common with Eastern religions. And this really leads to quite extravagant accusations on the part of Dio. I'll read you a section from Dio Book 80, chapters 11 to 12.
This is Elagabalus wants a wife, the god.
The god wants a wife, yes. I will not describe the barbaric chants which Sardanapalus, together with his mother and grandmother, chanted to Elagabalus, that is the god, or the secret sacrifices that he offered to him, slaying boys and using charms, in fact actually shutting up alive in the god's temple a lion, a monkey and a snake, and throwing in among them human genitals, and practicing other unholy rites, while he invariably wore innumerable amulets. But to pass over these matters, he went to the extreme absurdity of courting a wife. Sorry.
Wait. I'm going to describe all of these things and then say, no, I'm passing over them.
Yes. that is actually a Roman technique called praeteritio.
Yeah.
It's called, I mention something that I'm passing over, but in passing over, I mention it.
It's like a humble brag almost.
It is. Cicero used it a lot, which probably doesn't surprise
you. I won't go on about how great and I am at speaking and everything like that, and how great my letters are and how admired I am in the Senate. I'm not going to talk about all of that stuff that I just mentioned.
He also uses it to make scurrilous accusations about people, like, I won't mention, you know, the fact that he's in debt or that he's an adulterer. I will just pass over that, you know.
What was that term?
Praeteritio.
I love that there's a term for it.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, so we're not talking about all that genitals in the temple and everything.
No, we're not talking about that.
Okay.
But to pass over these things, he went to the extreme absurdity of courting a wife for Elagabalus, as if the god had any need of marriage and children. And as such a wife might neither be poor nor low-born, he chose the Carthaginian Urania, summoned her thence, and established her in the palace. And he collected wedding gifts for her from all his subjects, as he has done in the case of his own wives. Now all these presents that were given during his lifetime were reclaimed later. As for the dowry, he declared that he had received none from her except two gold lions, which was accordingly melted down. So this idea that Elagabalus has to be firmly integrated into the state religion.
I mean, it's establishing mythology, I suppose, by force.
Yeah. And we must think that some of these things are clearly the result of rumours about what Elagabalus is actually doing by people who don't understand his religion. For example, the fact that he's shutting a lion, a monkey and a snake, and then among them human genitals and practising other unholy rites, you know. This is clearly an extrapolation from the fact about his circumcision, you know, alleged willingness to castrate himself. And there are other stories about Elagabalus's genitalia, which we see throughout the tradition. So we find this sort of rumours coming out of that, coupled with, you know, tyrannical tropes, which we see.
Yeah. Now, the hazard in all of this is that a young man who's got all this power... Mm. And as he sees it, twin competing responsibilities almost is going to go too far. And,
yes.
And that's what I see as the main problem maybe with Elagabalus.
Yes.
Is that nobody's told him the safety word for the Roman Empire.
No one's checking him, really. But the women are concerned. You know,
they would be.
Yeah, Julia Maesa did not want to behave in this manner. So they are concerned, particularly with his relationship with the army. Now, it's interesting to think... You know, when we read the accounts of Herodian, Historagusta and Dio, many of the palace antics which Elagabalus gets up to are exactly the same as we hear about other young emperors.
Mm.
So, for example, chariot racing. He wore the colours of the greens. He raced chariots himself.
What's the deal with the greens?
They were just very popular.
The bad emperors loved them.
The bad emperors loved them, yes. And we know Caracalla, his father, you know, he wanted to continue that tradition.
Mm.
He's supposed to have drove a chariot drawn by four elephants on the Vatican Hill, which at this time has a circus. He also used the Caesarian Palace, which is on the eastern side of Rome, which is near the Lateran Basilica today, where the Church of Santa Croce in Gerusalemme is. And if you go there, you can visit the ruins of the Circus Varianus, which is named after Elagabalus, where he raced chariots watched by his mother, grandmother, members of the Senate, the prefects, for example. Again, this is quite similar to Caracalla. There's also a wonderful story in the Historia Augusta, Life Elegor Abilis 21, in which he had a banqueting room with a reversible ceiling, in which roses could fall from the ceiling, and so many roses that his guests would be smothered to death and not be able to crawl out from amongst the roses. And this is immortalized in the Alma Tadema painting from 1888 called The Roses of Heliogabalus.
It's quite a famous painting and probably the tamest thing that he could paint from that chapter of the Historia Augusta.
Yes, it's quite beautiful to see all the roses coming down, and just Google it, listeners, so you can see it.
But the rest of that chapter is just pure filth.
Oh, yes. But it's interesting that when we talk about the degeneracy of Elagabalus, it's not just the Historia Augusta.
Mm.
It's in Dio as well.
Yeah.
Herodian, interestingly, doesn't really go in for the sexual slander. So many of these anecdotes could be told about other young emperors. But where Elagabalus went further was his performance as a priest and his elevation of his god above Jupiter. And this would cause him real problems with the Senate and the army.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University, Frankfurt. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, where it's found in the shiny new history category. You can also find us on Spotify, Stitcher, and a multitude of other friendly neighbourhood podcatching platforms. Please leave a review in your chosen place. Put it on a paper aeroplane, fold it up, throw it in the direction of Melbourne. I'll catch it, read it, and appreciate it. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. You can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is, say it with me, at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, the sun is going to set. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You have been fantastic. And thanks for listening.